This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita!
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Listen closely. That's not just paint rolling on a wall. It's artistry. A master painter carefully applying Benjamin Moore Regal Select Eggshell with deftly executed strokes. The roller, lightly cradled in his hands, applying just the right amount of paint. It's like hearing poetry in motion. Benjamin Moore, see the love.
Welcome back to the Red Reporter podcast. Thanks to my incredibly awful ability to actually understand technology and record podcasts, this is take two on trying to record this dang thing. It's December 3rd. It's the day after the Major League Baseball non-tender deadline. And while we were all sitting around waiting to find out what was going to happen to Jonathan Villar and the likes of Domingo Santana and other guys that were kind of fringe candidates to get non-tendered, Kevin Gausman and Jose Peraza on the Reds end, the Reds just kind of casually went out and signed Mike Moustakas for us, 4 years and $64 million, making him the largest free agent signing in their team history. The timing of it was interesting. The fact that there were really zero rumors whatsoever connected to him before the signing was very, very interesting. And the fact that the Reds really hadn't been connected to anybody at second base, so to speak, in the process of them chasing free agents this winter, all kind of made it one of those things where we said, oh, that's a big surprise, but the more you kind of break it down and look at it, the more you can understand some of the reasons why they might have done so. So here to break it down, we've got first over in Indianapolis, Derek Grimes. Grimey, how you doing, buddy?
Hey, I'm doing well. I said it on the other one, bad, but I'm here because I'm dedicated to the Reds and Red Reporter, so...
Well, thanks for toughing this one out. Sorry you got to catch every single cold and germ from all of the kids over Thanksgiving break, but 'tis the season. So also joining us up in the Great White North, we have Aaron Michael. What's going on, man? How cold is it up there for you?
Bit chilly. Today was over freezing, so you know, it's like a nice balmy summer day, but got plenty of snow on the ground. And yesterday, my facial hair was all frozen up walking to work. So.
Yeah. Well, that's what you get for December in Minnesota. So thank you guys for joining me. I'm glad we've got some actual tangible stuff to talk about with the Reds and not just speculative stuff, because it seems like there's been plenty of speculation regarding them so far this winter. They've connected to the likes of Didi Gregorius, Yasmani Grandal, who obviously didn't sign with them. The Zach Wheeler rumors continue to fly about. But Mike Moustakas, 4 years, $64 million, a guy who has started 40 career games at second base, but the Reds seem intent on not just making him their second baseman of now, but also making him the second baseman for the foreseeable future. At 31 years old, guaranteeing $64 million, it's an interesting move. It's one that the deeper into some of the numbers I dig, the more I begin to kind of come to grips with. I think it's probably slightly a little bit of an overpay, maybe 1 year more than they would have liked to do. But the fact remains, it seems like it's one of those moves that the Reds did what they had to do to make sure they got him for 2020, which is the year that they seem dedicated to trying to make a push towards the playoffs. So I guess just your initial thoughts and reactions on the concept of the signing itself, and how he fits in with the Reds. Aaron, you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. I'll try to redouble my efforts from what I said the first time. With that, I saw it that evening, and it was surprising to me just because Mike Moustakas wasn't a name that any of us was really looking at.
Yeah.
Was the biggest thing. And, you know, he's a third baseman, but he played second base, and that's when everybody was making fun of the Brewers because they were just tossing people at second base and just saying it didn't matter. The guy's a 2-3 war player. He's probably not valued correctly due to the offensive output and the way they're valuing it now. I think they've toggled that based on league averages that have really lowered the way that us as fans look at that value, which I'm sure Major League Baseball teams aren't looking at it the exact same way, because runs are still runs regardless of a lot of people are scoring. In the end of it, I mean, he fills that need. When we were off the air there for that brief moment, me and Grimey were talking about the fact that we just added what? Possibly 30 dingers to to the offense that weren't there last year. You know, second base was a massive hole. This guy's going to go there and play it. We'll probably hide his defense using shifts and that kind of stuff in case he doesn't have that range that you think he's going to have that our second baseman would typically have. It plays interesting things in the lineup going forward based on what they do. It's an overpay, but who really gives a shit about what the payroll is in 2024?
Yeah, exactly. I think the payroll is an important point. And in my rant that I was going on when I dropped you guys and didn't realize it, I was pointing out, you know, $16 million to guarantee for a second baseman for next year seems a little steep on paper. But you start looking at what the Reds paid just last year. You know, they paid Scooter Gennett right at $10 million to be their second baseman. Obviously, that didn't happen because of the injury in spring training. They paid Derek Dietrich $2 million. They paid Jose Peraza $2.75 million. They picked up Freddie Galvis midseason. He played a lot of second base. They probably paid him about $1.5 million to $2 million to play over there as well. So you start looking at the total outlay for guys that they used at second base last year. It's about $16 million. So it's not necessarily even that much of a spending splurge for one position when you factor in exactly how much they spent there last year. Obviously, it's condensing it more into one particular player, and that involves more inherent risk. But it's also a guy who's got a pretty good track record. He hit 38 home runs for Kansas City a couple years ago in a ballpark that nobody hit 38 home runs in before, and that was before the ball even was more juiced and or streamlined, whatever you want to call it, than it has been the last two seasons. He's a player who certainly brings an offensive pedigree to the table, and it's an interesting one as well. We can dive into some more of the numbers later on, but he's a pretty unique player in today's day and age, generally well-respected in the clubhouse as well, and not a guy that I think when you say – largest free agent contract in team history, that brings connotations of it being the guy that you wanted from the start and you gave him all the money and got him, or B, the guy that's going to be the best player on the team next year. I don't think either of those are true for Mike Moustakas, and that's fine because I still think, A, the bar was set pretty low for how much money they were going to have to give out to break that record. And I do think he's a guy who still fits in pretty well as one of the better but not necessarily the best players on this roster. Grimey, what are your thoughts, man?
Yeah, I think – so as far as Mike Moustakas goes, like, I mean, I'd kind of kick that name around, I think, in conversation with you guys either on the website or in Slack or whatever. But it was that. It was kind of like – well, you know, hell yeah, like, go get that guy, like, go get Grandal, go get Didi, and then, like, in February when Mike Moustakas is still hanging around, because it always is, every February, right? Like, I don't know, toss him $20 million right. Bucks and he can play, you know, he can play the position, that's fine. I did not expect him to get, you know, $64 million and be the first signing, like you said. That being said, the way I look at it is, he's kind of, offensively, I think you could kind of plug him in as, and I don't want to say guarantee, but pretty much count on the offense that you thought you were going to get from Scooter Jeanette in 2019, or the offense that you did get from Scooter Jeanette in 17 and 18, except for he's done it for 5 years. Like, if he does it this year, it's going to be like, okay, yeah, that's what we would expect. Whereas with Scooter, we were kind of all wondering, like, well, at first we were all expecting him to pumpkin, and then the second year we were kind of wondering if he was actually going to, and of course he got hurt, and that's terrible for him, especially with the contract situation and everything. But essentially, I think Moustakas is basically that or better offensively, except for he has a longer track record. So that's great. And on the other hand, I don't see how he could be any worse defensively than Scooter Jeanette was. We watched Scooter Jeanette while he popped the ball around the infield for 2 years. And while it, especially in contrast back in 2017, what we had kind of been used to with Zach Cozart and Brandon Phillips up the middle for so many years, watching that defense was kind of bad. But I can't point to a game or a series and be like, oh yeah, Scooter Jeanette's second base defense like cost us that series or whatever. You know, they can hide it with the all the shifts like you guys mentioned. He'll be fine out there for the foreseeable future. Now, 4 years from now, you know, it might start getting a little dicey. Even 2 years from now, it might be good. But we're talking about 2020. This deal makes the Reds better for 2020. It's a bigger contract than I would have liked or that I would have expected. But, I mean, I don't care. It's not my money, and they have the money to spend, so go spend it.
Yeah, that's kind of where I am as well. And a couple notes about Moustakas as well. Last year was the first year he'd spent an entire season on a National League ball club. He'd always been in the AL. He'd always been in a ballpark, not just a ballpark in Kansas City, but a division where he played in a lot of ballparks that weren't necessarily conducive to a lot of power hitting. Detroit's not very hitter-friendly. Cleveland for most of the season is not necessarily hitter-friendly. You look up at where he was on August 26th of last year, in 121 games, he'd hit 31 home runs. He was hitting 263, 334 on base percentage, the highest walk rate of his career, and an 862 OPS. He took a grounder off the wrist in that game, missed a couple days, and hit 186 over about 21 games to finish the season. But he was well on his way to having an absolute career year last year before that kind of fluke injury. Not to say that he's ever going to not have fluke injuries. That's just what happens in the game of baseball. But you look up at where his numbers could have finished had he not done that last year. And last season would have looked even more impressive than it did even in its own right. He's a guy who I also last year, I think of the 139 players in Major League Baseball that had at least 500 plate appearances, he had the 10th highest fly ball percentage. And some of the names of the very few, all of the nine guys that were ahead of him and higher fly ball percentage, it was Mike Trout, Alex Bregman, Anthony Rendon. All of those guys are in that nine-person group. Meaning what? The best players and the best hitters in baseball today are the guys that have found ways to put the ball in the air. And Moustakas does it among the absolute best in all of baseball. You put that in Great American Ballpark as his home ballpark for 81 games, and suddenly you're looking at a guy who has immense power. I mentioned earlier, hit 38 home runs with in 2015 with Kauffman Stadium as his home park. He's also a guy who doesn't strike out, and that's the odd part about him, because so much of what you see in today's modern game is guys selling out for power, swinging for the fences, and strikeouts have spiked just as much as home runs have. He struck out, what, right at 100 times last year? It is the first time since 2012 he'd actually struck out more than 100 times in a season. So you're talking about a guy who's got prolific power but also doesn't swing and miss that often. Yeah, he swings at a few more pitches than he probably should, but when he does, he puts them in the air. And if there's not a better ballpark in baseball that is more suited for, I think, his batting profile than what Great American Ballpark provides. And when you kind of roll all that together, you give him one healthy season, and the idea of him hitting 40 home runs next year suddenly becomes a pretty realistic thing to expect. As far as I'm concerned. And so I feel like the Reds might have paid, expecting that to happen, and paid more for it than what his track record would have suggested they should have paid. But the fact of the matter is, it's what it took to get him to say yes, and I applaud the Reds for doing that.
It makes sense. He did. Didn't he spend 2 years ago, he didn't take a
qualifying offer, yeah.
The qualifying offer, and then he ended up making $6 million instead of whatever the qualifying offer would be. And then last year, I think he played for like $7.5 million.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
the guy took two of his prime free agent years and didn't make jack for what he probably should have made because of whatever's happening in baseball, and he just signed a $60 million deal. He's probably jumping up and down over it.
Yeah, I would say so. And you look at some of the free agent classes of the last 2 years and some of the guys he was kind of second fiddle to. Teams that were looking for third base options, Manny Machado was signed for $300 million. Josh Donaldson was out there as well. It's one of those scenarios where you really kind of wonder how much it cost him in that actual dollar amount value, but also how just 40 games at second base last year just proved that he can still be a little bit more versatile than he had proven before that. And suddenly he's getting $60 million to play second base for the Reds as opposed to being pigeonholed behind a couple of the guys as third base options. The interesting part, I think, about this as well is that, yeah, he's making $16 million bucks, but the news of the day yesterday came out at the same time that we found out that Kevin Gausman was non-tendered, so he wasn't going to get the prospective $10.6 million that he was going to be owed in his arbitration year. Jose Peraza was also non-tendered as well. His estimate was $3.6 million. So on top of what they paid for second base last year versus what they're paying for second base with Moustakas, that's $14.2 million that they basically slashed off the payroll for this year as well. So even though they announced the big signing, when you look at just 2020 payroll in itself in an isolated case, it didn't really do a whole lot to necessarily ramp up the payroll spending. And instead of a guy that was going to be possibly their third or fourth best reliever and their utility infielder, they got a guy they plan on starting and getting 600 plate appearances as their second baseman. I think it's a pretty interesting string of moves. What are your thoughts on, I guess we can kind of pivot here a minute, what are your thoughts on losing Kevin Gausman and Jose Peraza to free agency now that the Reds have non-tendered them? And are there any other aspects about the non-tender deadline that really kind of stood out to you? Grimey, how about you go first?
Yeah, I mean, for anybody that reads the site, I think I've been one of the bigger Jose Peraza, I won't say defenders, but maybe fans or believers than a lot of other people in Reds country. So, I mean, on the one hand, it kind of seems it sucks to see him go, especially realizing that he's still only 26 years old. And he was at one time such a highly rated prospect, and I don't know, it was a guy that was, in my opinion, he was a guy that was easy to root for whatever reason. I feel like a lot of Reds country doesn't feel the same way that I feel about that. But so on the one hand, kind of sentimentally, and I was the same way about Cozart for whatever reason. So sentimentally, it's kind of weird. It's kind of sucks to see him go. On the other hand, as far as the product that they're going to put out on the field, after his, we'll call it the three full seasons that he had here, it probably doesn't move the needle one way or the other. I mean, I kind of hope it's one of those things as a Reds fan, like I hope he doesn't go somewhere else and just tear the cover off of the ball. But, you know, personally, I kind of hope he does just for him, you know, but you know, for the baseball product, I don't think it does much for the Reds. I mean, it's hard to count, especially because he was a Super 2 guy, right? I mean, isn't that why he's making as much?
Potentially, he's going
to make as much as he was going to make. I mean, you know, it is what it is. I don't think the Reds are, even if he does go out and is a three or four war player for a couple of years for, you know, Tampa Bay or something, like, I don't know if the Reds are going to be like, oh, man, we really, you know, like, they'll be fine. Gausman was always interesting. I mean, I think one of the first podcasts we did this summer was, or one of the ones, first ones I did this summer was about Gausman. And he was interesting from the start, from the time they picked him up. But $10 million is a lot to ask for the role that he was probably going to be asked to play. So I get that. It would have been interesting to see if they could have come to terms with him, like giving him $10 million over 2 years or something. But I don't blame him for wanting to go out there and see what he can do, you know. So, I mean, maybe he still comes back. I mean, there's still a possibility. He knows the Reds. He knows, you know, the front office or whatever. So there's a chance that, you know, they could still grab him up on a – and, you know, put him in the bullpen and see what he could do. But they have work to do on their bullpen, so it would have been nice to have that in-house option. But $10 million is pretty steep to pay for it. So I think he's an interesting guy, and I think it would have been really interesting to see how 2020 played out for him as a Red, but I understand why they wouldn't want to do it for $10 million.
For sure. Aaron, what do you think?
I agree mostly almost 100% with Grimey. I was one of the people that, you know, apologist basically for Peraza, I suppose, saying, you know, young guy, he's going to figure it out. He doesn't strike out much. You know, he can play all these positions, and he doesn't, I guess, doesn't necessarily play them well, but, you know, he's good at them. But, I mean, I think we saw his peak in 2018, and while that was good, that's not otherworldly. And if he doesn't ever figure out how to take walks at a stable, consistent pace like he did in that year, he's not going to be a regular player, and you shouldn't be paying him real money. At that case, I mean, he's worse than replacement. You can, if you need a defender, you can call one up from AAA. You can call up an Alex Blandino, and he's probably going to give you equal value what Jose Peraza did for $3 million less. So hopefully he goes somewhere, figures it out, that kind of stuff. He would be a guy that I don't look to bring back at less just because he's been in the organization for so long. I would say that he needs to go find greener pastures and see if he can get the reps that are going to help him out, because Cincinnati shouldn't give it to him. Gausman, $10 million too much. I don't know if he's really the bullpen piece. I think it's interesting to find out. If he wanted to come back for $4 or $5 million kind of thing, I think that would be interesting. But, yeah, you don't bring it back a guy like that for $10 million, not at all.
Yeah.
You put that money elsewhere. I mean, that's the money you gave Moustakas.
Yeah, exactly. You know, Gausman, I think, he's one of those guys who obviously is a former first-round pick and a guy who's had a pretty solid success in his career at times being a starter, specifically pitching in Baltimore, which is an extreme hitter's ballpark, and pitching in the AL East against, you know, the stacked lineups of the Red Sox and the Yankees so often. He still had some pretty reasonably good career numbers. He's still young enough where I think he probably thinks he can still be a starting pitcher in Major League Baseball. And you look up at some of the big contracts that have been doled out to guys in recent history. You know, Patrick Corbin basically parlayed one really, really, really good season into $140 million. Zach Wheeler struggled mightily for much of his career, put together about a season and a half of really good ball the last year and a half, and he's staring at $100 million as well. I think Kevin Gausman realizes that, you know, yeah, he probably could have, and I'm guessing the Reds were negotiating with him potentially to stick around for a couple years and maybe be a reliever and a swingman kind of guy. He probably bets on himself and says, all it takes is give me 1 year, whether it's in Detroit, whether it's in Miami, wherever the hell it is, I'm going to go eat up innings and I'm going to show how good I can be as a starter. And that probably is a better long-term financial plan for me if I bet on myself, stay healthy, and get a chance to kind of reclaim my form. That's a better bet long-term than just taking the small-scale security of moving to the bullpen full-time. And I can't really blame him for that, given how there are a couple other comparables that have turned that into a very lucrative few years in recent past. Peraza, on the other hand, he's a guy that, you know, I advocated, even with his struggles at three and whatever million bucks, that the Reds should keep around. Two reasons behind that. One, as we mentioned, he's still just 25. It'll be 26 in April of next year. His 2018 season was a good one. It wasn't a great one, but it was a good one and showed you the kind of skills he had. For me, what I was worried about, and this is one thing that I think – I can come around on a little bit more the more I think about it. You look at what the Reds have in terms of shortstop options, not just at the big league level, but behind the big league level. They've got Freddy Galvis for 1 year, who just put up another on-base percentage season that starts with two. Obviously a brilliant defender and had a career on home runs this year, but not exactly a guy who screams current star or future star. Behind them, though, you've got what? You've got Alex Blandino, who's, I think, can probably cover shortstop okay, but isn't necessarily the best defensive shortstop out there, coming off a wrecked knee and, you know, obviously doesn't have a whole lot of experience there because he's played mostly second and third in the minors. And then Kyle Farmer, who's a catcher and a first baseman and a utility guy. But there's not really a whole lot else there. You've got Jose Garcia, who just played in advanced A-ball, who's probably at least 2 years away. Jonathan India, for a time, people talked about maybe he could play shortstop, but the Reds and the affiliates he's played for really haven't given that a sniff out there. there's really just not a whole lot of shortstop depth in the Cincinnati system. And for a guy like Peraza, I almost thought it was maybe worth $3-ish million with 3 years of team control just to keep him around in the as an insurance plan, because there's really not a whole lot else to turn to there. That said, the Reds can still address shortstop from outside the organization. And that's where I think what we saw yesterday is almost one of those kind of those arrows of the offseason where you see a move and think, okay, that's just the first in a series of moves, because they're going to have to find a way to rectify that down the road. And that's the one thing that I think I'm going to be watching significantly from here on out. Especially when you factor in that, you know, obviously Jose Iglesias is a brilliant glove at shortstop. And so the idea that Freddy Galvis was playing second base down the stretch makes a little bit of sense in that regard. But Galvis has never really played second base. And now suddenly they're going to move him back to shortstop and say, oh, yep, he's our guy, when he wasn't even that guy last year. It almost makes me think that they've got eyes on bringing in some shortstop reinforcements in one form or fashion. And that's the one thing that I'm kind of looking for in this, because they didn't just cut ties on the guy this year. They cut ties with the guy they could have had around for 3 years to help cover that spot. And that's the one thing I'm going to be watching significantly as the rest of this hot stove season develops.
I think that's an interesting point, though, because the estimated arbitration number was like, what, $3.6 million or something like that, right, for Peraza? I mean, they paid Jose Iglesias, what, two last year? So,
yeah.
I mean, that's a good point, because they could always do – they could go that route. And I don't mean – well, they could still go with Jose Iglesias as far as that goes, if they want to bring him back into the fold for a couple of years or whatever. But, I mean, I think that's a good point that I guess I didn't really – hadn't really bounced around in my head all that much, but – because they could go that route again. They could pick up somebody that was non-tendered and give him a spring training invite, and maybe he makes the team, and then it's $2 million, and okay, that's great. But they just gave up a guy that was only going to make about $3 million, a little over $3 million, that they would have had control over for 3 years. So, I mean, that's an interesting point for Peraza. Again, I don't think it changes – it doesn't change my mind if that they're going to really look back on this in 5 years and be like, damn, I wish we would have kept him. But, you know, it's –
well, I think it more reinforces mine. I mean, it's penny pinching, but the Reds are going to have a set budget number. I mean, there's going to be a number that they're going to come to.
Yeah, for sure.
If they tender Peraza, that's $3.5 million that they're going to have to pay regardless. And then if he's not the guy or not good enough to be on the roster, they're going to keep him at AAA. They're going to spend money somewhere else to bring that in. That could be potentially another $3 million I just don't like the idea of Peraza rotting on the bench kind of thing. That he's never, I mean, he's 25 years old. He's never going to get any better. They'd be doing him a disservice. They'd be doing the team a disservice.
It's not really a role. I'll just real quick. It's not a role that he's ever really excelled in either. Like, Peraza seems to get, and you know, relative or better is a relative term, but he seems to get better the more at bats that he gets. So him sitting on the bench as a 24th or 25th guy, and then you try to put him out there, it doesn't seem like that would really work out either, you know.
And he's not a pinch hitter.
Yeah, 100% not. And he's a guy that gets better when he plays, and when he doesn't play, you can see that it's not his best spot to be in. For me, it's interesting also because it's a turn the page moment for the Reds from the 2015-2016 era of trades, when you know they tried to trade for him twice. Initially, the Aroldis Chapman deal with the Dodgers that fell through, where he was supposed to be a major part of it, and then eventually they traded Todd Frazier and got him in that deal as well. He's a guy who is a low power, non-walking, high contact, speed and contact guy. And not only did they technically replace him at shortstop from where he started the season, you know, going into last year, he was supposed to be the starting shortstop. Right now, it looks like the starting shortstop is Freddy Galvis. He ended up getting shifted over to second base when Scooter got hurt. Now you look up at the starting second baseman going into next year, it's Mike Moustakas. They went from a guy who is speed, contact, low walk, low pitch count, to two guys who excel at hitting the ball in the air and hitting home runs. And that's just kind of where baseball has gone. You know, Galvis did it last year better than he ever has before. Moustakas has made a career out of it. It seems to me like it's almost an organizational shift in philosophy as much as it is about the money, because let's face it, they got two guys that are going to try to hit the ball out of the ballpark on every swing. Whereas with Peraza, that was 100% not what he tried to do at all. And it's interesting to see them kind of tilt towards that, considering that's pretty much what baseball has become the last couple of years.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, they traded for Peraza, what, 4 years ago?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's been a front office shift since then. I mean, Walt Jocketty made that trade.
Yep.
And he's still sucking down Dr. Pepper and green beans up in the press box, but he's not making the moves. I mean, they have a president of baseball operations who wasn't even the GM when they made that trade, I don't think.
Yeah, you're right. That's right. That's absolutely right.
Mostly they probably sat on their hands and Walt Jocketty said, I want this slap hitting guy that can hit 300. Yeah, he doesn't walk. Who cares? But he'll steal 30 bases. He'll slap the ball around the field. He can play three positions. You know, that's a Walt Jocketty ideal leadoff man.
Yes, it is.
Do the one time. I mean, that's like right up his alley. I mean, they might as well just called Peraza, you know, David Eckstein or something.
Well, and really, as far as going back to turning the page or whatever, it kind of it turns the page on the Reds era, but like it turns the page on potentially on that. The Reds building that way on that baseball era in general, because when they got him, I mean, Peraza would have been, had Peraza been all older, obviously, like he would have been perfectly built for that Kansas City team that won the world, that went to two World Series and won one that Mike Moustakas was on, right?
Oh, hell yes.
That's how they won baseball games, was putting the ball in play.
Contact doubles and steals. Yeah.
I'm just scarily looking at David Eckstein's BB Ref page right now too, and like that was way too apt to what I just
said. Yeah, don't do that to yourself.
Just thinking what David Eckstein, you know, walked 40 times a year and had like 300 plus on base percentages, but other than that, like Jose Peraza is David Eckstein.
Oh, good Lord.
Like maybe they're like, yeah, he'll walk 30, 40 times a year. Like this is just an anomaly. He'll figure it out. But no, they're the same person, like identically the same person. Statistically, and it's just stupid. I looked it up, and I'm like, well, I mean, he walked, but that's the same.
I think the other aspect of this that's it's not gone unreported, but it's kind of been overlooked is that Nick Senzel was the number as high as the number six overall prospect in baseball by some publications last year. A universal top 10 prospect, had never once played an inning as a professional center fielder before starting last season and pretty much being told you're the center fielder. Now you've got Eugenio Suarez entrenched for years at third base. You've got Mike Moustakas entrenched for years at second base. Nick Senzel is coming off major shoulder surgery that ended his year last year. It's pretty clear that he's the center fielder now. And that's something that I think I'm okay with, given on the limited amount of time we got to see him out there last year. He's clearly a plus athlete. It clearly has enough speed to play out there. Clearly has an arm, assuming his shoulder is fine, that can be in a very good one from center field. It's not an unimportant part of this entire series of transactions, because the concept was heading into this winter, let's hope Nick Senzel is ready to start the season next year. But who knows with that shoulder? Maybe they might need to move him to second base because he can't make the throws that he otherwise would. To me, this sounds a pretty clear alarm that A, they're committed to having him be the center fielder for not just next year, but for the foreseeable future. And B, I think it shows to me that they think he's healthy enough to be that guy going into 2020, which is good, because you look at the free agent market out there and there are no good center fielders out there that the Reds can just go sign. What are your thoughts on how that means Senzel fits into this 2020 Reds team that you're hoping could finally make a playoff push again? Aaron, how about you go first?
Obviously, I love Nick Senzel. He's my dude.
He's your dude.
You know, I was the guy screaming from the beginning to draft him. I think Nick Senzel is going to be a fantastic player. I think, you know, first year, whatever, didn't work out the way it wanted to. He did show he could play center field and play center field pretty well. Not only that, he's got a gun out there. But I'm actually – the biggest thing about Nick Senzel, and I hate the critique of it, is obviously, you know, it comes down to the injuries thing. And as soon as you started to talk about this, I thought about a guy I read about on Wikipedia. So you might need to settle in for a bit of a story.
I'm here for it.
Because I freaking love this guy. I mean, this is the biggest sense of irony that I'm probably using wrong in my, and I use wrong my entire life. There's a man by the name of Roy Sullivan. He was a national park ranger in Shenandoah National Park in Virginia. He got struck by lightning 7 times in his life. Seven.
Well,
to the point that he thought God hated him and was chasing him and like trying to like kill him, like ran away from thunderstorms.
He got struck by lightning 4 times and then got struck by lightning 3 more times. It's absurd.
Yeah, all within like a 30-year period. There was one time, I got to find it. He lightning hit the top of his head, set his hair on fire, traveled down and burned his chest and stomach. Sullivan turned to his car when something unexpected occurred. A bear approached the pond and tried to steal a trout from his fishing line. Sullivan had the strength and courage to strike the bear with a tree branch. He claimed that the 22nd time he hit a bear with a stick in his lifetime. So it's the 20th time he's beat off a bear with a stick, and I should have phrased that better. But got struck by lightning 7 times. And you want to know how this guy died?
How did he die?
He shot himself in his bed with his wife by his side.
Oh, God.
So the entire point, reason why I'm telling this story is that Nick Senzel's entire baseball career up to this point is Nick Senzel's an awesome guy. He's, all great at all these baseball things, and he's playing all these different positions, and he's just a freak athlete. But the dude's got vertigo and migraines and allergies that they don't know what's going on. And then his thing in his shoulder explodes. He didn't need surgery, but that still doesn't sound good. So Nick Senzel is going to be playing center field, but like, could we be more worried about anybody else that's playing on the team right now if he's actually going to be able to play an entire season?
Unfortunately, you could, because Jesse Winker has been almost a snake bit by injuries as well, and that's who the Reds are leaning on in left field. Your point's incredibly well taken, which is you got to count on the guy because you have to, and because he's that good when he is that healthy. But you've got 2/3 of the outfield in Winker and Senzel that's penciled in to start every single day or most every single day that are coming off major shoulder injuries and have 3 years in a row where basically their seasons have been cut short because they've gotten hurt. And you pair that with the fact that you've got Aristides Aquino as your everyday right fielder penciled in. And he's a guy that you thought so highly of that you designated him for assignment, 14 months ago, before he finally burst his way back onto the lineup as well. So, we talk about the fact that the Reds still have space in their payroll to go out and get another big bat and an impact offensive player. And the fact that they kick around the idea of the outfield as that spot to be, it prompts a little bit of a response from a lot of people because they're like, no, we got Winker and Senzel and Aquino. Yeah, you had Winker and Senzel and Aquino last year, and look who else played in the outfield because they had to. Matt Kemp, Yasiel Puig, Scott Schebler, Derek Dietrich, Josh Van Meter, Jose Peraza, Brian O'Grady, Phil Irvin, all those guys got time in the outfield because you have to have more than 3 outfielders. You've got to have 5. You've got to have 4 really good ones and preferably 5 really good ones and find a way to make that work. It's one of those things where I love the fact that they're willing to basically say, look, Nick Senzel, stop worrying about where things are going to go. Center field, do that, be that. That's your spot, be that guy. But I still think they need to go out there and find a way to find reinforcements, whether it's a guy who profiles as a corner outfielder who can also cover center field, or just as a center fielder who has a good enough bat where he can also – fit in offensively at a corner outfield spot. They've got to find somebody else to help be part of that rotation. And I think that's what they've left themselves in payroll space to be able to go do. It's just going to be really, really interesting to see who it is they kind of target to go do that.
Yeah. My thing about Senzel and center, it's not so much, I mean, all things being equal and let's just assume that he comes back and he's fine from the shoulder injury, which I think he did have surgery on back in September, I think, which, it is what it is. But all things being equal, like, there's no doubt in my mind that Nick Senzel can play center field, and there's no doubt in my mind that he would get better at it as he played it. I mean, he's a good enough athlete to play it But it kind of goes back to what you guys are talking about, especially with somebody from everything I've read about Nick Senzel, from everything I've heard Nick Senzel say, that dude plays baseball like his life depends on it. And that's right. Great to have as a center fielder. That's great to have. I mean, that's exactly what you want. But when we're talking about injuries, we're talking about, you know, like he's going to go balls into the wall, literally. You know what I mean? Like, and so the only thing that I was kind of like, if they were to bring him back as a second baseman, you know, at least he doesn't have things to run into. He's still going to go balls to the walls. He's still going to dive all over the place. But at least he doesn't have things to run into, people to run into. You know what I mean? Like, that's because, you know, you get hurt that way. And it's not that's nothing on him, and he shouldn't dial it back because of that. I'm just saying, like, that's the only thing that worries me about him out there.
Yeah, and I mean, we talk about all of these moves that have been made. I think that what it comes back to for me in looking at potential moves as well, David Bell's the guy who adores versatility. He adores being able to have a full roster where he can mix and match and double switch and pinch hit and do all of those things. And the more ways guys can impact games, the better as far as he's concerned. Obviously, with Moustakas, you've got a guy who can play second base and third base and has proven it. I wouldn't be at all shocked if you begin to see him start get time at first base to spell Joey Votto here and there, whatever. The idea that Senzel is still wedded to center field, I think it's one that's a good one to make sure he gets enough reps out there to be good. But I also would not hate the idea of him splitting time in center field and second base either. You start looking up at other guys that the Reds could target to try to bring in to help complement that entire idea. And he's not the biggest mauler in the world. I think they kind of took that out of necessity by bringing in a guy like Moustakas who can hit a lot of home runs. But I keep coming back to who we landed on in the SB Nation simulation a couple weeks ago. Whit Merrifield, a guy who plays for the Kansas City Royals who are going nowhere, who is on an extremely team-friendly contract and plays everywhere. He could be your starting second baseman. He's played a ton of center field. He can play the corner outfield spots. And as a guy on such a cheap contract that, yes, it would take a lot of prospects, good prospects, to land him in a trade, but is also the guy who basically builds in insurance at every single position across the diamond, which when you've got an entire diamond that is versatile in and of itself, seems like that kind of player that would fit perfectly on the way the Reds have set this roster up. And so I'm interested to see whether the Reds pivot into trades because of the big splash they made in free agency, and where he kind of ranks on their trade target list, because he's a guy that I think both budget wise would allow them to spend more money on the bullpen, and also roster wise going forward for the next, what I think, four seasons, would give them cover at every position where they might need some cover, while also basically guaranteeing he could still get 600 plate appearances a year. So in the wake of the Moustakas signing, that's kind of where I'm looking now, is to figure out how they can find a guy that still fits while allowing everybody else to continue to get the amount of playing time that it looks like they should deserve.
Yeah. Hey, so we're at almost 41 minutes. Aaron dropped out here. Like, I can still see him in the room here, but he can't hear or see us. But no, that's a bummer. I don't want him. He shouldn't reload his browser though, right? Because we might lose his track. Or yeah. Can he reload his?
I would say don't reload your browser. I would say let's just wrap this probably pretty quickly, and I'll see if we can't go ahead and edit this down, because we do have 41 minutes of good stuff, and probably that's right about where we try to keep it. So, I don't know if you've got any further thoughts on.
No, my last thing would be just to get off on what you were talking about there with Whit Merrifield, is because I think it's also interesting, and as far as trading the prospects, we talked about these moves kind of pigeonholing Nick Senzel in the center field, but it also really completely blocks Jonathan India for the next 4 years. I mean, he's not going to be taking over in the foreseeable future for anybody in the infield. And I think they've kind of decided that he can't or shouldn't play shortstop. They pretty much stopped that altogether back in 2018. Right. So, I mean, it's not to say that he couldn't play a corner outfield spot, in the big leagues, but if we're talking about a guy that, you know, can play second, can play third, he's not playing second or third here for at least the next 3 years, right? So he's firmly on the market, and he's a top 100 guy.
I mean,
you know, top prospect.
He's a guy that in theory the Reds were willing to trade to get JT Realmuto last year as well. So the idea that the Reds are willing to move on from him or use him to get somebody better for now is not terribly outlandish.
Right, I think it's a good starting point for the Reds talking to the Royals, right? This is a guy, I mean, they're pretty deep into a rebuild as far as, I don't know that they're going to be competing in the next 2 years, and India probably should be up within the next 2 years, but you still got him for 6 or 7 years after that, right? So, I mean, it still fits their timeline. Right. So that would be the last thing I would want to say, just because I think it's interesting how he fits into this now, just because the infield is pretty much locked in for 4 years. I mean, three, you know, two and a half, three, especially. I mean, you can start trading guys off in the last year there, in that fourth year, right? But it's pretty much locked in, except for shortstop. If they don't think he can play shortstop, which I don't think they think he can, or he would have been playing shortstop, because we've already covered how they don't really have any in-house shortstops, right? I think.
No, I think that's the case.
Him firmly on the trade block.
Yep. Well, it's going to be interesting to see how the Reds kind of pivot with that. Obviously, they've got umpteen options they can chase from here on out. But it certainly does seem like the idea of trading him, yes, it would deplete the farm system and take another top prospect out of the system. But it's also like they've backfilled that already. So, yeah, I'm going to be watching the heck out of that and see whether or not he becomes the next big first-round draft pick the Reds used to go augment their ability to make the playoffs. They did it with Yonder Alonso. They did it with Yasmani Grandal years ago. It's one of those things where they did it with Taylor Trammell last year. So maybe he's the next one to go.
It does feel like they're kind of in that same 2008 through 2011 time frame, you know. They haven't won a division yet, right? But it seems with the moves they're making, like – they're kind of heading for that. Okay, like, we're going to spend this money and now we're going to trade these guys to get there, you know, for the next 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, good stuff. Thank you, Aaron, even though you can't hear me right now because you dropped off our podcast. Thank you, Grammy, for joining me as well. You can find us at redreporter.com. You can obviously find us on iTunes and not Spotify yet, but SoundCloud and everywhere else you can find podcasts. We are the Red Reporter Podcast. On Twitter, we are at Red Reporter. Check out our stuff. We're going to continue to cover this active Reds offseason, all hot stove season. And obviously the winter meetings are coming up. They're just a week away, and I think you're going to see continued action on the Reds front there as well. So with that in mind, we'll go ahead and wrap this episode. But yeah, the Reds made their first big splash, and it looks like there's more in the pipeline. So for Aaron, for Grimey, I'm Wick. Thank you for joining us, and we will talk to you next week.